Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Simon Kirk, legendary drummer with two of my favourite bands of all time, Free and Bad Company. So welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I want to start, I suppose, obviously with Free, and I want to look at a specific observation or how, what the music has meant to me and many people who watch and listen to what I do here is that if we go back to 1968 to 1973, it was the golden age of rock music, blues rock turning into rock, progressive rock, heavy metal, whatever you want to call it. And it was the time when musicians were stretching out Enemy and Sounds and Melody Maker were having the best guitarist, best bass player, best drummer. And lyrically, songs were all about shooting from the hip. They were more kind of centered in that area than they were about from the heartfelt music, etc. And then there's Free, who kind of, for a group of teenagers, had this sensitivity to their music that came from the heart. And I'm thinking of, which makes you unique in many ways, with like Be My Friend, Still I Love You, Heavy Load. No one else was showing this kind of vulnerability. It was all kind of very macho around that time. Were you aware that as Free developed, that you had this kind of almost reflective approach to your songs?
Good question. I mean, look, at that time, and you alluded to it a couple of minutes ago, it was this, particularly around, I would say, 66 to 69, it was the most fruitful time musically in England, not necessarily in America, that came a little later. And a lot of it was down to the blues boom. Now, if you combine that with the rise and the reign of the Beatles, you have a strange conundrum where you got this, like, as you said, we were teenagers in 68, me and Paul Rodgers were 19. Andy, I think, was only about 15. Wow. Koss was a year younger, so he was 18. So we were teenagers. So we were still very vulnerable to outside influences, and we adored the Beatles. I mean, we really adored them. We would have these little listening sessions in Andy's house in Roehampton in London, where we would bring an album each. The four of us would convene in his bedroom, and we'd listen to the album of the week. And invariably, there was a Beatles album, as well as Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters and Clapton, you know, the Beano album and whatever. So you had, with Paul and Andy writing these very sensitive songs, and it's amazing you mentioned Be My Friend. That really is possibly one of my favorite Free songs, and I'm sure a lot of people out there will agree. Very sensitive, very beautiful. We were, you know, we were going through the throes of first love, you know, 18 and 19, your heart beats faster than it will ever beat in subsequent years. So it was a strange conundrum and strange meeting of these two types of music, the lyricality of the Beatles and the grit of the blues, if you will.
Because on the first album, Tons of Sobs, obviously that really was almost like your set list of what you were doing at the time. And that really pulls in the rawness of the blues, doesn't it? Kossoff's playing on that album is...
It was our live set. And in fact, Guy Stevens, our lunatic, but lovable lunatic Guy Stevens, said, you know, just play your set. And we bookended it with Over the Green Hills.
Yeah, brilliant, yeah.
A lovely little, almost a little folk song, if you will, which I guess gave a glimmer of the lyricality that would come in later albums.
Because and it started to literally, I would say, creep in, pardon the pun, with the next album, with things like Lying in the Sunshine and, you know, Free Me and Morning, Sad Morning. It was a kind of, this is 1969 now, so the, you know, Cream are about to implode and Zeppelin's albums are coming out. But it was a very, because it's not just a sensitivity of lyrically, it's sensitivity of you as musicians, because no one overplays. Everyone was almost respectful of the dynamics of what you were each doing.
Right. And also at that time, 69, the band had come on our musical horizon. And the band actually, you know, with music from Big Pink, there, once again, you had Chess Fever, that great riff and that backbeat, that snare drum, that growling organ. And then you had, you know, the other more lyrical songs that the band had. The band, that album had a profound effect on Paul and Andy. Not so much me and Koss. We were still very much steeped in the blues and more edgy sort of music. Yeah. I became a convert maybe a year or two later with the release of the second band album. But so Free, the second album, as you said, contained Morning Sad Morning. You know, we had Chris Wood on flute from Traffic. We were still, I was very much into James Taylor. You know, James had released Sweet Baby James. There was still this push-pull between the more sensitive songs. And then, you know, Zeppelin were ruling the roost and more edgy music. So it was still a process of musically evolving.
You obviously, for Fire and Water, you have the, which I've heard you say before, you've got All Right Now, which was a care for what you wish for moment, because it was a song that's has literally took on a life of its own almost from the get-go, really, and just bounced in and out of the charts every decade ever since. But nevertheless, that album itself, which is, you know, a classic with Don't Say You Love Me, Heavy Load, Remember, Oh, I Wept. These are, again, it's like rock song ballad. But
I mean, and even now, you know, 55 years later, there's still this push-pull thing with me. You know, I mean, I listen to Mozart. I listen to Charlie Parker. I listen to Joni Mitchell. I listen to Taylor Bloody Swift. I listen to anything that's good. You know, I think it was Duke Ellington who said there's two types of music. There's good, and then there's the other type. And it's true. I mean, music does not have any specific parameters. And I'm still very much influenced by good music, whether it's written in the 18th century or written last week.
Your style as a drummer, because I can go back to when I was first discovering the band, and obviously when I was at school, you know, people, whether it was guitarists, it was always Richie Blackmore, Jimmy Page, all these people. If it was drummers, it was Carl Palmer, Ian Paice, John Bonham. Yeah. But you were also mentioned in the same world where I was at school, but your style was totally different. Most drummers, most guitarists came from the blues. Most drummers came from jazz. I mean, was that similar to you? Did you come from a kind of jazz influence background?
No. Okay. No. Okay, there's several types and several layers or levels of jazz. And for me, the most attractive form of jazz is big band swing. And that was the aha moment when I first saw my very, very first program on a black and white TV back in, 63 or 64, when All That Jazz, a program called All That Jazz on ATB. And it was, the very first time I saw an image on the screen was this 24-piece big band. And it's not that far removed from rock and roll. You got that... You know, it's that it's swing. It actually swings as opposed to bebop or, you know, modern jazz, which is not really my cup of tea. So to a degree, big band jazz got me going, as it were, and I still love listening to it. But what really the thunderbolt moment for me was hearing Al Jackson and Otis Redding's drummer. Yeah. And it was Booker T and the MGs. And that, to this day, it's still my number one. He is still my number one influence, Al Jackson Jr. It was the simplistic, solid backing of the song that really, really appealed to me. Not that far removed from Ringo, you know.
Yeah,
he was a great field drummer. And there's a big difference between the likes of, let's say, Carl, who's a wonderful drummer, Simon Phillips, you know, this, this, you know, who can play, you know, 7/4 and you know, that's his gig. That's his thing. Simon's an incredible drummer. Ian too, considering he's only got one lung. I don't know if you knew that.
No,
he's
only had
one lung all his life. Wonderful drummer, but that really wasn't my style. I was simple and solid, and my guys were Levon Helm, Al Jackson, Ringo, Charlie Watts, you know.
But your style was just absolutely right for the part, for the bringing together the parts that made Free. So All Right Now is almost a signature tune for you yourself, and again for Koss with the simple chord structure, but the so well created guitar solo in the middle, and obviously Paul Rodgers is really angst-driven vocals, and obviously Andy Fraser's bass. But where you mentioned your influence in soul music, now you've said that, I can feel that now in tracks like Mr. Big, where especially on the Free Live version, where it kind of builds up from Cossie's solo and Andy Fraser comes in with bass, many other drummers would probably have seen that as an opportunity to put loads of fills in and to build up to the momentum climax of where it was going. But you just keep that steady, literally soul kind of feel to the song, even though it's underneath, everything's going on.
You really can't, in my particular style of drumming, and that song, I mean, that was Andy's, you know, that was his spotlight song, to do that. His most incredible, he was doing his solo was in eight. So it's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, one, two. He did this incredible thing. There's no way that, number one, I didn't even want to start playing fills because I would have lost that momentum, that bedrock upon which Andy, you know, was doing these amazing runs. So it never, ever even occurred to me. And it's funny you should mention that because I played with Warren Haynes from Government Mule, who grew up with loving Free. And he called me recently and said, look, I'm doing the gig in New York. Would you come and play Mr. Big? I said, fuck me, Warren. I haven't played it for 55 years. But I'll give it a go. And you know what? It was really, it was great. And I just committed to doing that solid, because you can, Phil, you can build without being busy. If you keep it simple and solid, you just have to hit harder. That's basically all it is. And the live version of Mr. Big was really something else.
Totally. And again, looking at the kind of the sensitivity between the musicians in Freeze, that it's sometimes, I know people have always said this about Paul Kossoff, it's what he didn't play that was just as important, what he did. But there is lots of kind of space. I mean, if I think of the track Heavy Load, just before it comes into the guitar solo, there's like a pause where almost the music just hangs in the air and he comes in with a note that's so, that beautiful reverb, and it's just a note.
Yeah, that's one of the most beautiful tracks,
It is incredible. And I think Rodgers' voice, the way he comes in, and it's so raw with emotion when we head towards the fade. Were you aware, you're only young teenagers, you're all respecting each other as musicians, but did you start to think that, you know, this, our guitarist here, he's not playing a million notes like some of the other guys in our contemporaries, but he's rather special?
Well, it was just slightly before what I call the Dwiddly Brigade. You know, the late 60s. I can't think of any, you know, people like Satriani and Steve Vai, you know, Eric Johnson, you know, Robin Ford, these wonderful guitarists, but not really my cup of tea, although Robin Ford is. But the others were a little too busy for my taste. So the only person around at that time who came anywhere close to that genre, the two guys would be Beck and Jimmy Page. And they were busy, but they weren't over busy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Koss, the thing about Koss was he was just 100% feel. What drew me to him, when I saw him in the Black Cat Bones in the Nag's Head pub in Battersea all those years ago, was his passion And he was only a little guy. He was probably 17 when I saw him. The others in the band were kind of average, like an average cover blues band. But yeah. Koss really stood out because he was not a busy player. Had he even been alive today, he would never have gone down that road. He was all about feel. And that's what really drew me to him was his feel. And you mentioned All Right Now, I still think it's one of the greatest guitar solos ever committed to the vinyl. And I believe it was three takes, and we took a little bit, a snippet from each, and put it together. Koss was a sublime player when he was healthy.
And the next album, which was... It was seen as a disappointment because it didn't have another All Right Now on it. But I mean, The Stealer, to me, to my ears, was just as good and so inventive as a song. And I know the version that wasn't used on the album does have a long solo by Koss on it at the end, which, you know, which should have perhaps gone on the album. However, that album, Highway, does feature, it's my favorite, it's probably. This is one of my favorite Free albums because of Be My Friend and, Love You So, et cetera, and Soon I Will Be Gone. The one thing I'd like to just say at this point is that something about the way you work with Paul Rodgers and the whole band was, and there was that box set from about the year 2000, which was just full of outtakes that came out, is that every time you did a song, it was slightly different than another performance, as if like you just said that Kossoff played by feel. It sounds like you all did. So how you felt on the moment you recorded was how the song came out. It was
very good. Yeah, yeah. That's a very good observation. We never did more than, I would say, four takes. Although All Right Now was the exception to the rule. Because and that's a guide, and I'll get back to your question in a minute. The thing about All Right Now was it was such a joy to play. Yeah. We didn't mind. We broke down halfway through, or someone fluffed a note, or we had to start all over again. I believe the take that we used was take 24.
Wow.
Yeah, and not that we did 23.
Yeah.
Takes. You know, there were breakdowns and so on. But getting back to what you were saying earlier, that we never did more than three or maybe four takes at the most, because we always rehearsed, because, you know, we had no money in those days, and you cannot, it's financial ruin to go into a studio when you're paying for everything and learning the songs with the red light on. So we had rehearsed these songs quite a lot before we went into Ireland or Basing Street or wherever it was. And I believe Be My Friend was around about the time Hendrix died. Ah. And I remember getting the news, and Koss was completely devastated. And he did the solo to Be My Friend. And when he walked back in, he said that was for Jimmy. So that would date when that particular session was. Because we found out that really, once you've gone past four takes, if it ain't sounding right, leave it alone, come back to it. But 9 times out of 10, it did happen within those four takes.
Another observation, and this goes all the way through to Bad Company, actually, and it's kind of a focus on Paul Rodgers in a way, that in the song structures that you had, you know, verse, chorus, solo, chorus, is that as you headed towards the fade, that's when almost like an extra level of magic came out of Free and Bad Company stuff, where Paul Rodgers would ad lib a vocal as you move towards the fade. And that's happened throughout the Free and Bad Company catalog. Yeah. But if I've noticed it happens so many times where you just wish it didn't fade out, you know, it's just magical.
I think, you know, that's great. I never thought of that before. But there's, you know, most songs are in sections. And I guess when you've got over the final seventh of the eighth pieces, let's divide a song into eighths.
Yeah.
You've managed to hurdle all seven of the eight pieces well and to your satisfaction, then the last 100 yards of the race is like, yeah, you know. It's
a, yeah, that's a good point.
And
yeah,
it's true. And Paul would subconsciously think, fuck it, we've nailed it, now I'm going to wail. And I'm not a huge fan of fades, I have to tell you. If you listen to Run With The Pack, the outro is just enormous. We were steaming and absolutely, and it was a fade, and I regret it. But there it is. It was the vogue of the time. So there it is. But no, that I think that's my answer to that observation.
Thank you. Now, obviously, around this time, we've got the band kind of split up. We've got Free Life comes out. Kossoff was starting to become involved in drugs, and I know that you yourself and many musicians from your era took drugs, etc. But some musicians took that because they came off stage, they've had all the adulation, thousands of people cheering for you. You come off, you're buzzing so much, you want to stay up at that level.
True.
But for some other personality musicians, it was almost perhaps something that helped them have the confidence in the first place. Maybe they had imposter syndrome. What Kossoff's draw towards it?
You're coming out with some great phrases, Phil. Imposter syndrome, that's a good one. Well, look, I think the bottom line with Dear Koss is that he was an addict, and he was an addict from a very, very young age. Before I met him, when he was 17, he had been institutionalized for addiction to uppers.
Oh, right. You
know, Brinamil and blues, or whatever we call them, that students took to cram, to get through.
Yeah.
Get through exams. So he was an addict, pure and simple. And I am myself. I know I have an addictive nature, and I've lived with it for pretty much most of my life. So you get these some musicians, take Angus Young from AC/DC, never had a drop of alcohol in his life, and appears to be this lunatic, great guitarist. I know, Robert Plant likes a drink or two, fine. I mean, he can take it or leave it. Poor old Bonzo was an addict. I mean, it's just whatever celestial finger zaps you, you got to live with it. And the thing about Koss was, the thing about us as a band and the management was, back in the late 60s, early 70s, when the addiction really brought Koss to his knees, it would be around 70, 71. We were so ignorant about hospitalization, putting the guy, instead of taking a week off, he needed to go to rehab for 3 months. He needed treatment. And it's something that he never, ever got. And the disease just blossomed and eventually killed him.
I guess a lot of people need to probably don't realize that now there's more support for musicians for mental health and stuff like this. But of course, back then, the industry was just as young as the bands. So a lot of the people in the record labels weren't that much older than the artists, were they?
That's true, yeah. And we were on a roll. I mean, when All Right Now came out, suddenly, we were doing a different country every other day instead of a different town. And then with the relative failure of Highway and Steeler not following up, how can you follow up All Right Now? I mean, it's just impossible. So what happened was that Paul and Andy felt that the band had gone as far as they could go, and they wanted to try something new. And that really broke Koss's heart, disappointed the hell out of me, because I thought we should have just taken some time off. But anyway, that's what precipitated Koss really down that awful slope into full-blown addiction.
But did that period, did that give you yourself personally a chance, because you're not just a drummer, you play guitar and piano, to become, look at songwriting, because the next project was Kossoff, Kirk, Tetsuya and Rabbit, where you actually, you wrote some great songs. Thank and obviously had a go, obviously started to sing as well.
Yeah, it was, I was of the opinion, where are we now? I was 23. I mean, God.
Wow.
Still so young. In 72, I was 23. Koss was, I think, 2 years behind me. So we were, you know, we were still babies. I thought, well, fuck this, you know, I'm not going to roll over and play dead. We'd hooked up with this wonderful keyboard player, Rabbit. It was amazing. Yeah. Tetsu was a simple solid. We were kind of throwing off the shackles of Free, that suddenly this repressive, and the last 6 months of Free, round one, if you wish, were really horrible. We went to Japan, we went to Australia, no one was getting on. We had this sort of sword of Damocles hanging over us that, you know, February the 18th was the last show that we would ever play. It was horrible. So when all that was in our rearview mirror, if you will, to get a chance to work with two guys who were great musicians and had no baggage, it really opened up a lot of possibilities. And I guess in the back of my ignorant mind, I thought this would help costs. And it actually didn't. He got worse and worse. He really missed. He missed Free. He missed Paul Rodgers. He loved Paul, and it just did not happen. And of course, we never toured behind that album, which I still think is a pretty damn good album.
I think it's one of my favorite albums. I mean, your song "Hold On" has got a great solo by Paul Kossoff on it, hasn't it? And "Dying Fire." I mean, did you arrange those songs yourself, or as a composer, did you do it?
Well, I was going through a romantic breakup. Dying Fire was a romantic breakup, and that was just something that came out. So yeah, I just played. I discovered piano. That was the first time I actually was writing on piano, and so there was no arranging per se. I just sat down at the piano and fleshed out the chords. And Rabbit was a huge help, even though he'd come up with me and say, well, that flattened sixth doesn't sound right. I said, Rabbit, I wouldn't know a flattened sixth if the fucking art. But it was musically, it was such a departure from Free. And I did enjoy it. But, of course, the vocals were not. They were okay, but they weren't great. And we did miss Paul Rodgers and Andy, but I didn't miss that cloud that was hanging over us.
Yeah.
The last 6-7 months, you know.
Was Free at last recorded just before that or afterwards? That's when you came?
No, we reformed. We reformed after about 9 months. I mean, none of our individual projects were a success, and you know, Paul had Peace,
yeah,
and he had Toby, and I, you know, me and Koss had KKTR, but it wasn't happening, and Koss was getting worse. And I remember calling Paul and saying, you know, he's really in a mess, man, he really misses you, and I think that's what made Rodgers pick up the phone and call Andy and say, look. And, you know, with our tail slightly between our legs, you know, we said, well, fuck it. Well, let's get back together. And we got back together primarily for costs, because we thought this will do it. This will get him out of the slump.
And all the Free at Last, all the songwriting credits were shared across the whole band. Was that to help Paul as well?
Wonderful gesture. Yeah. And it's something I'll never forget coming from Paul and Andy, because, yeah, they wrote all the songs, and to give us equal credit, I think was a wonderful gesture. Yeah, wonderful.
And then the final album is Heartbreaker. which I kind of feel behind the scenes it was heartbreaking to make, although it's got, I mean, Wishing Well was a big hit, and all that's again. Just touching on the sensitivity of the band, numerous people have done Wishing Well, and they've done great versions, but it's kind of been more, it's always sounded more heavy-handed than the Free version, which has got, again, this soul to it. I guess the...
It's funny you should mention, I mean, yes, it was a quite a hit for us. And it's funny, I know Larry Mullen, from U2, and you know, he's the generation behind me, and he said he grew up That was one of the first songs that he learned in 1973 when it came out. I think he was about 12. And he couldn't get the feel. And I said, well, you're probably playing, you know, fours on the hi-hat or eights on the hi-hat. Any drummers out there will know what I mean. I played fours. So it's da-na-na. It's almost like an All Right Now beat. Da-na. Instead of, you know, which tends to suffocate the feel. So, and you've got this riff. Da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na. Now, if you marry that with eights, a very busy feel on the drums, it kind of suffocates the sound. It doesn't allow the sound to breathe. So that's all I can say about that one, Phil.
No, it's good. And the Come Together in the Morning, it's got one of my favorite Koss moments on that, where you almost feel the pain that he's in as he's trying to, I guess, stay within the band that he loves with his friends, but that equally his health is just pulling him and his demons are pulling him away from it.
Well, this song was written, you know, with Koss in mind by Paul. I don't think Paul ever realized, you know, he might have got an inkling. It makes me sad to think of you because I understand you do. You know, we were just watching this wonderful guy who actually drove the band. He was the band's driver until we were roadie. I mean, no one else had a fucking driving license. So Koss was our driver. But, of course, as his health declined, we got a roadie to do all the driving for us. So we saw this wonderful, wonderful guy, you know, slowly descend into this awful pit of addiction. It was horrible. Heartbreaker was horrible because you never knew which type of Koss was going to walk through the door, whether he would be lucid, relatively sober, ready to go. The solo on Wishing Well was great. He was on fire that day. Yeah. And then the next day, he was just a complete mess.
Yeah.
And I think what happened, Phil, about halfway through when we were behind schedule to deliver, and Koss was once again late, really late, and I think, you know, me and Rogers said, you know what, fuck him. And I know that sounds heartless, but when you've lived with someone, and I'm sure there are many parents or siblings out there who go, I know exactly what you mean. You think, fuck him, you know, let's just get someone else and finish this thing. So Rabbit said, I know this great guy from Texas, Snuffy Walden. Snuffy came in, two takes, it was all done.
Yeah.
Lovely guy. And I think Koss, that really was one of the final screws in the coffin for him, because when we told him not to come in, like Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett.
Yeah.
We're going to pick him up. He said, no, keep driving. It was a case of sheer self-preservation.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, the album finishes one of my favourite Free tracks, which is Seven Angels, which is probably the heaviest song Free ever laid down in a way.
Yeah. I know that was, I don't know what Paul was smoking when he wrote that, but bloody hell, the imagery.
Yeah, the imagery is fantastic.
It's amazing.
I just want to touch before on Bad Company, obviously, because this was, it's still got that feel, but it was obviously more of a stadium, a different feel to the music in a way. And also, your songwriting appears more in Bad Company than it did in Free, as you've become more established in what you're doing. And I know there's a few songs on, I think Straight Shooter's one of your favourite Bad Company albums, isn't it?
And it is the one, yeah.
And that's what We've No More is on there.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful song, and also it's got the strings on it as well, hasn't it? It's just joyous. I've always loved it.
Well, that came, and it was a gentle nick from Aretha.
Ah.
She had a live album out called, I forget it, it's a double album, and it was her recorded in a church in LA.
Oh, I know the one. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Amazing Grace.
Yes, that's it. Amazing Grace,
And one of the songs was called Mary, Don't You Weep.
Yeah.
It was a gentle gentle 6/8 groove, and it just that phrase stuck in my head, Mary, don't you weep. So yeah, I think that's the first song that really I was 100% proud of having written. And when the strings were put on it, I was just almost in tears. It was just such a beautiful rendition. And I think my songwriting kind of blossomed from that moment on.
And was it your decision, or did Paul want to put Anna on, which was on the Kossoff Kurt Tetchian Rabbit album?
He loved it. Yeah. He did like it, and I was just playing it in the studio between takes, or someone gone for a sandwich or gone to the loo, or whatever. And he said, "Wow, what's that?" I don't think he'd ever heard the KKTR album. And I said, "Oh, it's just." He said, "Oh," and he started singing it, and I thought, "Fucking hell! I hope he wants to do it." And he said, "Let's do it," and we did, and yeah, lovely.
Yeah, because that's a great thing, isn't it, about Paul Rodgers, is that it doesn't matter who's written the song, he sounds as if it's one of his. Whenever he sings, it sounds like it came from him.
Wonderful. He's really, and I'm not a big fan of Rolling Stones polls, and to put him at 55 out of the 100 top vocalists of all time, come on. He's up there in the top five as far as
he absolutely easily he would be in the top five. But Mick Ralphs is guitarist in Bad Company, and he comes from obviously Mötley Hoople, a very different sounding band. But as it's probably another one of my observations here, but as we go through the career of Bad Company, he kind of blends in more as if if the spirit of Koss is following him in his guitar playing. Was that something that did you notice that?
It never really occurred to me, but. Now that you mention it, I think when you play shoulder to shoulder with Paul Rodgers, I think there's something that imbues your style of playing. You don't want to get in his way. It's not, you're not going to play over him. It's almost like his voice is a guitar.
And
Paul Rodgers plays great guitar, great lead guitar. So it's funny that you should say that, because when Mick is just jamming, he's kind of busy, very soulful. But when he's with Paul side by side on stage, he defers to Paul singing and never, ever gets in his way.
Because again, going back to what I said about Paul Rodgers, the way he had libs towards the end before the last part of a song, it's the way that Mick Ralphs plays his lead. Is it almost a question and answer to Paul's voice?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, especially on Simple Man from Run With The Pack, which is a gorgeous song.
Yeah.
Again, it's left with enough space for Paul's voice and message to come across. And Fade Away off that album, which is a beautiful song. Again, Mick Ralphs has there's a kind of ghost of Kossoff in that. Again, probably because the way that Paul Rodgers is singing it, it feels that that's the way the solo should be delivered.
Yeah. You know, Mick, I remember a thing B.B. King said years and years ago. He said, "I play with a lot of geniuses, but I much prefer to play with people who I like." And I'm not saying I love Paul. He was like a little brother to me. But with genius comes a lot of baggage. And I mean, I knew Koss. I played professionally with Koss for 5 years. Two of those years were sublime. Three of them were just utter heartache. And I played with Mick Ralphs, who is not a genius guitar player, but he's a very, very good guitar player.
Yeah.
And he's a lovely guy, and he's a lovely friend, and I love him to this day. And I would take my relationship with Mick Ralphs over mine with Paul Kossoff, because it was just such a give and take with Mick.
Yeah.
With Koss, bless him, it was just take. There it is. And Mick's playing was, he every day he would come in and play something that knocked us sideways. He was that good. But even he would admit he's not a genius. He's just a very, very good guitarist.
Because his style changed very much when you were together with Brian Howe, wasn't it? Dangerous Age. Mm-hmm. Rick Ralph was playing very differently then. Very much more out front in a way.
I think his ego and his confidence took a little bit of a hammering with when we played with Brian. You know, the style of the band changed. You got a little more hair bandy.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And his mix writing, songwriting without Paul didn't really carry the weight that Feel Like Making Love, Shooting Star, Good Love and Gone Bad. You know, he didn't have a writing partner anymore, and his contribution kind of suffered a little. And Brian Howe and Terry Thomas came in and kind of took over the band, and Mick kind of took a back seat. And I think his playing did suffer a bit, although he was professional enough to still rise above it. It just didn't achieve the heights that it had achieved with the version of Bad Company with Paul.
You do have there's a song called 100 Miles off Holy Water, which is one of yours, which is probably that one to me does definitely move back towards the version of Bad Co with Rogers. I can almost imagine Paul singing that.
I wish he had done. I was with Ronnie Wood once. We were in his house. We were watching one of the first videos ever made, you know, for rock and roll. And it was Dylan.
Yeah.
And he had all these, you know, 20 by 15 cards.
Oh, the cards. Yeah, I've seen
them. Yeah. And he's throwing them. And and it just sowed this seed in my head that you know, I would have a song which, if there was ever a video made of it, would have these cards with Sharpie on them. So it became 100 Miles. And when I finished it and we were submitting songs to Brian and Terry, the producer, Terry Thomas, at the end of the session, he said, well, there's only one fucking song here and it's 100 Miles. So the rest are not very good. And like, oh, my God. I mean, part of me was pleased, but the other part of me was like, wow.
Yeah.
And when we came to do it, you know, Terry said, you should sing it and we'll get an accordion. And it was such a departure from the rest of the...
Yeah, it stands out. Yeah, it's not like the others at all. Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah. And the other song, because I just skipped over, is Peace of Mind from Burning Sky, which I know Burning Sky was a bit of a... It kind of had a different feel.
Yeah.
It's like a step down. But, I mean, there were some great moments on that. And I think Peace of Mind is one of them. I mean, again, Paul Rogers' vocal delivery is just stunning.
Well, yeah. And we were kind of scraping the barrel a bit because when we did Burning Sky, we were in the Honky Chateau.
Yeah.
In the Chateau d'Aroville, just outside Pontoise. And we got there and we were under the gun to deliver an album. You know, back in those days, we were smoking and drugging and we didn't realize that we had deadlines. So when Peter Grant called us up and said, you know, when are you going back in the studio? It was like, oh, well, he said, well, guys, you know, whatever month it was, you got to deliver by, you know, within 4 or 5 months' time. So he's like, fucking hell. Okay. So when we all arrived at the Honky Chateau, I think we only had about 4.5 songs.
Wow.
And Bowie was there and he was recording in his album. And we got there and Bowie came out on the lawn and said, listen, guys, we're running a bit late. Do you mind if we stay another couple of days? We said, take your time. You know, so we shared the Honky Chateau with David and Iggy. We even had a jam while we're frantically trying to write songs. And we eventually, there were some good songs.
There are, yeah. Leaving You is a great track. And I guess Master of Ceremonies and the last one on side two was where you were trying to fill up the space, I guess.
Yeah, that was a Stone 7-minute jam. and then I Would Love to Go Wandering. You know, there were a couple of dodgy fillers. But there was Burning Sky. There was Every Man Needs a Woman, Peace of Mind. You know, there were... there were maybe 4 or 5 very good songs, but the rest, no, it was not a good album overall.
Well, you had a fantastic career with that band because obviously Desolation Angels came out in 79, mm. which obviously put you completely firmly back on the map, which was a great one. And I know the next one, the last one, of course, was the one with Electric Land on it, wasn't it? Rough Diamonds, which I know by then you'd started to fracture completely.
Yeah.
And then you come out the Brian Howe era and have a complete rethink, and the band comes back together. I think one of the things from my perspective as a fan is that you never really did another studio album with Paul Rodgers.
No.
You played lots of tours.
Yeah. I mean, but when Paul rejoined in 99, you know, things were never quite the same because we had dared to go, you know, to go on Forge Ahead without him. And I did not want the band to die. Because Paul didn't want to work with us anymore. It just seemed wrong. And as much as I appreciated his decision to strike out on his own and with the firm and the law and so on, you know, I'd been a part of this band for 7 or 8 years and I really didn't want it to die. So when he came back, there was a little bit of friction between him and me and Mick and Boz. And it never really resolved. You know, I would have loved to have gone back in the studio. We got on with it. You know, we're professionals, and you know, we had a couple of good tours. I mean, it was always a pleasure to have him singing because I loved playing with his voice, playing to his voice. But things were never quite the same, you know, after that.
Yeah. So coming up to date now. You're living in New York, and you're also heavily involved with a couple of your. I think you're on the board for is it Road Recovery and also Right Turn to help help people, to help young people.
Yeah, we help in Road Recovery. We help troubled teenagers and kids in their early 20s. We have an age limit; you can't be under 16 without parental consent, and you know it's open ended. But they're primarily they're youngsters. We teach them with music. We have a 12-step meeting, and then we get them to pick up a tambourine or play guitar. Some are musicians, some aren't. And I've been with them now for about 15 years. Right Turn is up in Boston, and that's a recovery rehab unit primarily for musicians and artists. So, you know, we're just trying to give something back to a society that's helped me immeasurably over the last 20, 25 years.
Do you feel that because a lot of people have grown up and they've got married, divorced, had children, bought houses, lost houses, gone through their whole lives and listening to Free and Bad Company and all the other bands that you've been involved with, that there is like a distinct healing power of music in that obviously it's helped you personally coming out of your addictions. Do you feel that, I mean, is that how you're, when you're talking to people and not necessarily musicians, that music does, you know, almost heal in that respect?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's the only true international language, Phil.
Yeah.
I mean, people in Alaska like AC/DC as much as they like them in Tierra del Fuego or Greenland or Thailand or whatever. You know, it's a really unifying situation, any music. I mean, and it has the power to make you feel that you're not alone, you know. And now with the advent of social media, you know, people can swap. Oh man, did you hear the new Beyoncé album or the new Taylor Swift? Did you, you know? And it's most incredible how the world has shrunk. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not crazy about computers and the internet, but I'm an old guy. I think the internet is a double-edged sword. It cuts both ways. But it is, music is certainly, you know, I get things on my website, you know, letters from people who followed me in the band. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all the years. And, you know, I've been in touch with, you know, I love Bonnie Raitt, and I got a chance to write to her. And the first thing out of my mouth was thank you for all the years. And it's so true. I mean, if we were to ever meet our musical heroes, the first thing out of our mouths, 9 times out of 10, would be thank you for all the years. And we're just passing it on, man. You know, that's all we're
doing. Well, I totally relate to that because I I'd have to say, Simon, thank you for all of the years, and thank you for song, you know, for being on songs like Be My Friend, which lyrically is just as powerful now, all these years later, as it was then. And for lots of people at that age, whatever age, those lyrics and that feel of that song just resonates and gives hope, and, you know, comfort, and I'd say healing, because it's timeless music, which I guess for now you didn't imagine when you were that age that all these years later people would be still talking about it.
No, I did not. I would have tried to play it a little better. What is it Groucho Marx said? If I'd have known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself.
And finally, Simon, is it, I might have this wrong, but are you working on a play called Rock Bottom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm working on a rock opera, rock music.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Called, it's about addiction. And we had our first table read yesterday. It went very well.
Oh, fantastic. But
it's very slow. For theatre, it's a very slow process. And I don't know when it'll hit the stages, but it's starting to sound very, very promising. So I'll keep you updated.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic. Well, thanks very much, Simon, for all of your time today. I really, really appreciate it. So take care, and it'll be great to talk to you about Rock Bottom when it's closer as well.
Will do. Thanks again, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye. Well, a huge thank you to my guest, Simon Kirk from Free and Bad Company. And I know Simon has played with other musicians as well. But those of you who know me know that Free and Bad Company are two of my favorite bands, and Free especially. Those of you who watch my videos on YouTube and seen them on the Now Spinning magazine website, where I've looked at certain Free albums in a bit more in depth, know how emotionally connected I am to those albums, the music itself, and the musicians that composed and played on those tracks. So to talk to Simon is just fantastic. And as he said towards the end of the interview, I'll say it here, thank you. Thank you, Simon, for all of the years. Because the music on the Free albums is timeless. If there's seven albums, each one of them is different. The feel, the emotions played. And as I said at the start, there was something about those four kids, because that's what they were, who played with a level of sensitivity that was unlike all the other bands around them. And it's, you can still pick that up today, the space, the timing, the way that they respect each other, in the way that the guitar, bass, drums and vocals move in. And as Simon said, that in Bad Company, the way that Paul Rodgers sings kind of invites anyone else who's in the band with him to kind of almost question and answer, create a conversation with the music, which is, I think, how, as he said, Mick Ralphs changed his style to be with Paul's singing. But fantastic, fantastic music from Free and Bad Company. You can't go wrong to just dip in there. And yes, the Brian Howe period is different, but it's still worth exploring. You know, it really is. So thank you again, everybody, for all of your support. Check out the website at nowspinning.co.uk, the YouTube channel where you can become a member, you can become a patron. Check us out on social media. We're on X, Facebook, LinkedIn, Threads, Instagram. We're everywhere. We're even on TikTok. So remember, music is the healer and the doctor. Please subscribe, share with everyone you've ever known. But it's great to have you here. Take care. Keep spinning those discs, and I shall see you all very, very soon.